Welcome to the Niagara Friedberg Quarterly Conference Call. I'm David Rothberg. Today is October 29th, 2015. Before I introduce Al Friedberg, just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. If you have any questions, I've got a bunch of them already. If you have any further questions, you can email them to me at drothberg@niagaracapital.ca. A podcast of our conversation, the conversation we're going to have with Al Friedberg, will be placed on both the Friedberg and Niagara sites within an hour of the end of the call. And what else is there to say? A couple of people have asked me who I am. I'll just say quickly that I'm the founder of Niagara Capital and an investor in both the Friedberg Global Macro Hedge Fund strategy and also the Friedberg Asset Allocation Strategy. If I'm not mistaken, I think that's all the housekeeping. And now it's my pleasure to introduce you to the portfolio manager of both those funds in which I am an investor, Al Friedberg. Good morning, Al. How are you today?
Good morning. Good morning, David. Thank you very much for the clarification, David. I wasn't sure.
About what, Al?
Your role.
About my role, right. No, I was, okay. You're welcome, Al. You're welcome. Al, let's start off by asking the obvious question. You're up 12% for the quarter. You're up 15% on the year. There's been no disaster. You're only leveraged at around, only leveraged at around 2.5 times the NAV. You're mostly long. The question is, are you really Al Friedberg, or has your identity been stolen by an ex-mutual fund PM from Fidelity?
No. I don't think that. I think we have changed the method of operation, and we can talk about that. But no, I don't think that there is anything different. We are long. When you say we are mostly long, true. We are mostly long today. We are mostly long equities, yes. We are short a few other things. But I really don't think that there's been a change in a qualitative change. I think there's been more like a trading strategy positioning type of a change, which we could discuss.
Well, let me help you with my question. I think that fundamentally, you have a reputation, and I don't think that it is ill-earned as an investor who sees disaster and has an appetite for disaster, is tempted by disaster, and likes to make big bets on disaster. You have no big bets. You're mostly long. You don't see disaster. There hasn't been any disaster. Is this to say that your vision and your portfolio reflects a vision of a world that's less or that's more benign than many concede?
Okay. First of all, I do have a tremendous appetite for disaster. Yes. Now, as far as seeing disaster, I don't think that I'm seeing that, and I think that that's mainly the main thing. I'm seeing problems. Problems that we saw already 2 and 3 years ago, problems in the emerging markets and emerging economies. I'm seeing problems in Europe. But I also am seeing that a lot of that can be contained and is being contained. And I also see strength in the North American economies and budding strength in Japan, so that I don't see a generalized problem of disaster. For example, 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I was generally concerned that there would be a banking crisis in Europe that would end up actually engulfing the entire developed world. It has been postponed. It continues to be postponed. I think that some way will be found, and obviously now it's becoming clear that the way to be found to ease those concerns is by making the taxpayer pay it without him knowing that he's paying for it over long periods of time. So we have found ways to socialize those losses and to contain them, to cushion them. We have created a political buffer in a way. So that is no longer a major concern. I did have a concern also over the past 3 or 4 years that an accident would take place, and that could still happen. For example, we just saw what's happened in Portugal now, where the socialists, together with the communists, now have obtained probably more votes than the ruling conservatives, and are advocating an end to the euro imposed austerity measures. Now, an accident can happen. Meaning, I mean, they can come into power and they can immediately announce that they will default on all the debt and that they will default on the programs imposed on them by the euro officials. So, you know, these things can happen, and it's still it's a problem. But I think that even if they do, I believe that Germany so far has shown a disposition to cover a lot of those costs. And unfortunately for them, I believe that that cushions the impact and will cushion the impact, and some way will be found to ease these countries that are in trouble from that burden that they have today, or what they consider a burden that they have today, including Greece, which has really just agreed under duress to some of the terms. But it could, any day it can happen that it can change. So the time bomb. That time bomb that I was so concerned with 3 or 4 years ago, that could explode and can explode suddenly. It can bring everybody down with it. That seems to have been diffused, not solved in any way, but diffused. There will be losses, and the losses will be carried by mostly taxpayers. And so, but it won't threaten the world. Now, the Chinese slowdown is gradual. It's happening. It's well advertised. It should have the impact of what Japan's slowdown recession had in the 90s. Maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. It will have an impact on commodity prices because they're big users of commodities. But again, those things are built into the structure already into prices. They're built into prices. And I don't think that will have a suddenness effect on the world economy. What is more interesting is that we have a very strong basis in the U.S. economy, for example. We have a very strong basis for further growth. We have a far more liquid consumer, a far less indebted consumer. We have a consumer that received a huge benefit in the form of lower oil prices. I mean, we're talking about a gain for the U.S. of maybe $500 million a day, this drop in prices, and it may become even bigger. So that's supporting consumption, and that's supporting savings. We have corporations with ample liquidity, have not put their money to use yet in CapEx. They will be putting it to use there. There is good news on that front. There's good news on the fiscal front. A much smaller deficit, more manageable, and with the prospect that maybe the next administration will look at some of the more serious problems like entitlements. So I see the U.S. as in a good spot, in a very good spot. Canada maybe not as much, but still dragged by the U.S. upwards, and I see Japan in a good spot. And generally speaking, I think that we're not likely to have that terrible, scary scenario that was potentially there at the time that the banking crisis was so talked about. So I don't have a bearish disaster view, at least for the next 6 months, 12 months. I don't have that view. And as a result, I'm more able to build positions that are more comfortable. And right now, the comfortable positions are mostly on the long side.
Yeah, let's flesh those out a bit. Let's talk about the portfolio in the vacuum of disaster absence. This shocking absence of disaster. What are you long? What are you short?
Well, let's say that you're talking about the main themes that we have today.
Yeah.
Well, many of them are the same we've had for a long time. So I'm just repeating. So, you know, you must have heard it before, but I'll repeat it. We have a large exposure to home building. again, the fundamentals remain very strong. The pace of home building is insufficient for the demand. We see prices continuing to rise very quickly. There is some problem there in that labor is beginning it's difficult to find, and so costs are probably increasing too. But the general picture is one where there is a huge demand, pent-up demand. House formation is very strong, and it's going to benefit the home builders without a question. We are long also a substantial position we have in airlines. Their economics have made an enormous change. We have transformed this industry after 30, 40 years of losses. It's well-run, well-managed, consolidated down to maybe four or five airlines. They have good control over pricing. We think that it's – and they're cheap, and they're really cheap. Again, we have a position that we've held for a long time. Nike, the Nikkei, the Japanese play, which we think remains very, very strong. By the way, on a relative basis, equities in Japan offer far more returns than bonds, and it's only a matter of time for that mentality to change. And I think that the Central Bank of Japan is actually forcing a change in mentality. We are seeing pension funds being forced, literally forced, into buying equities and getting out of bonds. And this is part of the BOJ operation. And we also have the administration saying, you know, we want to see better governance, we want to see better returns on capital, and creating an index that shows which companies are doing well. And so there's a change in mentality taking place in Japan, and that's important. And the recent floating of the post office that they have, the post business, which is a huge banking business too, and is successful, it will also help to change mentality towards equities. So again, we remain long there and happy with those positions. We have a modest position in advertising long via Google and Facebook. We think that they really control the advertising market today. And from a technical point of view, they look extremely good, well-positioned. And a new position that we added recently is Canadian banks. As a group, we bought a group of Canadian banks, the leading Canadian banks. We thought that they had been punished too much for fears about their exposure to the oil patch and fears about the housing market in the big cities like Toronto, Vancouver, and probably also the fact that the Canadian dollar dropped so much. Canadian dollar dropped 25-30%, and I believe that impact had a short-term negative impact on bank prices. That when you judge bank prices, you should be judging them on international valuations, and the drop in the Canadian temporarily took them out of whack, so that I believe that now it will be catching up to their better valuations. So, you know, they enjoy good dividends, they make a lot of money, they have very good margins, and they're relatively cheap in that sense. By the way, that's a position that runs contrary to our general belief that we should never really own financial assets because they are black boxes and it's very difficult to know what they're doing. But we believe the Canadian banks are probably the best of the bunch and probably the most conservative of the bunch. So we'll write them.
And they famously pay a nice dividend.
Yeah, and they pay very good dividends. On the short side, we still have a smattering of India short. The Modi reforms or the Modi revolution is not happening. It's just not happening, and it's just a difficult country to make changes to. State banks, we are short state banks, and their state banks have large losses and getting larger. And we're still short a modicum of Brazil, though, you know, a good part of the move has already happened. We've been short Brazil for years now. Short some energy stocks, not so much as a substitute for being short oil, but on the assumption that at $60 oil, these few companies that we short here, are not going to make it. So, by the way, the other day, British Petroleum said that they're working and operating with a $60 barrel price, and at $60 to be able to continue paying dividend and continue doing CapEx. But below that, it will become difficult and we'll have to cut dividends. So, and this is British Petroleum, so we think that a lot of energy companies will make it before this is over. We are short a larger position in Apple. We got short recently Apple and think that it's way overowned stock, way overowned, and a stock that can it's not likely to be able to grow anymore at the same rates of growth. And but the technical position, the overownership of the stock, I think makes it difficult for it to go up. If anything, we should see some bouts of liquidation very soon. And we also short a little bit of Tesla. Overpriced, overhyped, I don't know what to say. Crude oil, we have begun to go back. We got out and got back into the crude oil, profitably got out and going back in now. We think that a second leg is coming, a second downward leg is coming. And we don't know how far. I think that we may be into the low 30s, but we'll see. And then we also short a number of emerging currencies. Now we've only recently we have begun to go back into the currency trading area, an area that we were at one time very active and for many years left it. And now we have come back. We are short currencies like Taiwan and Korea, sort of a bet around China, a more transparent bet on what will happen to China. And we still short Brazil. And basically, that's the picture. That's the picture in a nutshell. I mean, here and there, there may be a couple of small positions, but that's the basic picture.
Okay, thank you. Let me circle back to Japan and Canada, if I may. You talked about a new culture of equities in Japan. What does this mean to the JGB if you're going to move out of bonds into equities there? This has been one of the most anticipated trades of the last 10 years.
Yeah, well, I don't know what you can say about Japanese bonds. I mean, they barely pay anything. I think that the long-term JGB pays less than 50 basis points. So I don't think that there is I don't think that there is a default risk here because of what I said in the past, which is the Bank of Japan buys up these bonds and eventually will be able eventually they're retiring those bonds from circulation. So there'll be less and less of those bonds around and the burden of the debt on the country will be reduced to nothing. So I think the only thing that's going to make those bonds go down, and the same thing, by the way, will happen in the U.S. and in Germany, is the threat of inflation or the threat of accelerating inflation. If that happens, which we think there's a good chance that may begin to happen, then you'll see those bonds go down.
What about Canada? If you're speaking about $30 oil, the effect of the collapse so far has been hard on the Toronto Stock Exchange, hard on the Canadian economy. There's been some anxiety that the Bank of Canada may lower rates yet. How do you see it playing out in Canada?
By the way, when it comes to oil, I'm pretty sure of the cap, and I've maintained for quite a while now that oil will stay down for a long time, but below $60. I think that's the main point. The move to 30 is technical, and I think it may happen, and it could. It looks like it's going to happen, but and if it does, it's going to affect again the oil producers in a big way, especially the Middle East producers. Will it affect Canada? It probably will affect Canada in a big way as far as provincial governments. Alberta will be affected a great deal, but I don't have a view of the Canadian dollar. I don't have a view. I imagine that it will have a bearish impact on the Canadian dollar in the near term.
Okay, so then let's move on to something that's not specifically Canadian but has a Canadian theme, and that's gold. You've been active as a trader of gold futures. You've also been very active in Canadian gold mining companies. How do you see gold, and what views do you have, if any, on Canadian gold miners?
Let me first start by saying that I'm a bull on gold. And by that I mean I believe that gold prices will go up and will make new highs. When, I don't know. But I certainly in our lifetime.
There's not that much long left, you know.
You're right. But let's say the next 40 years.
Next 40 years. Okay, we'll be around.
But I'm bullish in gold. I think that again, it's part of the same thing as we've been talking about for the last few years, which is the fact that financial assets are becoming less credible. There's less integrity to in the fixed income market. There's less transparency there. Take countries like China that own enormous amounts of U.S. debt, and they're now starting to liquidate some of it. They probably are not very comfortable owning a lot of U.S. debt. It's just too much of it. So there aren't any good alternatives. And of course, some of the alternatives are equities, and I think that you see that by way of sovereign funds, pieces that get taken out of the international reserves that countries have and are placed in a fund called sovereign funds, and these sovereign funds are more flexible. They do other things. One of the things that they do is buy equities, and I think it makes sense. The equity premium is substantial, and I think it makes sense for them to do that, to diversify into equities. But I also think that it makes sense for them to if they want to be a little more independent, less dependent politically and militarily even on other countries, it makes sense for them to own an asset like gold. So that's one reason for the demand. Another reason for the demand, of course, is the traditional demand that China and India have had, and these countries continue to grow in terms of monetary balances. So, you know, we have continuous demand from there. We do have continuous problems in expecting. Let's say that production supplies over the next few years are going to be difficult to are not going to be increased at a very fast rate, and in some cases we may see actually a decrease in supplies. It's difficult to find gold mines. It is difficult to bring them into production. It takes many years, and it's costly, very, very costly. So, you know, we're talking about a commodity that's trading barely above its marginal cost of production around the world. So that's a good sign. That's a supportive thing. And the last and maybe the most important thing coming up is the possibility. I raise it as a possibility. I don't have yet enough evidence to say that it's more than some reasonable probability, but not better than 50 or 60% yet, that we're going to see accelerating inflation in the West. And if we do, gold will react very well. So generally speaking, I think the price is starting to improve, and you can see gold improving by the fact that it's no longer losing ground to equities. That's important because equities are the main alternative, and that's important.
What about the gold mining equities?
Very cheap, and I think that they're a great place to be.
Do they have much upside, do you think they have?
Yes, they have much upside.
Okay.
Unfortunately, they're too thin. It's very difficult for us to... for the funds to move into that area, but in the actually the asset allocation fund, the smaller asset allocation fund does have a position today in gold mining equities.
Let's circle back to inflation. Via a comment you made about housing stocks. You talked about rising labor costs in home construction. There's been some talk that rising labor costs are going to crimp margins, and that as a result, equities are going to stall. There's been another school of thought that says rising labor costs are going to result in a rising CPI and a shocking inflation print at some point in the not too distant future. Are these two views mutually exclusive? What's your take on this?
You know, inflation is a generalized phenomenon, and it's, we call it a monetary phenomenon. You can't really predict where it comes from, where inflation will begin, or where it's going to begin. Is it in the goods area? Is it in the services area and the labor area? Money will find a way to express itself, or let's say accelerating money growth will find a way to express itself in one of these areas. So it may find its way in the labor market first, because we're getting pretty close to full employment in the U.S. We're, you know, maybe full employment is 4.5 or 4.7. We don't really know, but we're getting very close. So it may find its way. We have anecdotal evidence that there is some shortages developing in as an example, in home building in some areas. So it may begin there. We may begin to see rising wage claims. It's not likely to happen yet in commodity prices, because we see that commodity prices remain relatively weak still. But there's been some substantial cutbacks in production in many areas today. And so we may see the commodity prices bottom sometime in the next 6 months. Then, I'm not really sure where to expect it, but I am pretty sure that if we continue doing this, which is creating the possibility of increases in money, we have increases in the U.S. of money, of broad money, around 6.5%. If it accelerates from here, and if it accelerates from 5% in Europe, you will see rising inflation, and then the picture begins to change. Then you know, you want to be short bonds. You have to be very careful on the equity side. You maybe want to be long gold. It's a different picture when you have accelerating inflation than what we have today.
Now, you were a graduate student during the time when Milton Friedman's monetary work was to business schools what postmodernists were to the humanities. Especially, I think, on the monetary side, a lot of that has been discredited by what's happened over the past 20 years. Are you still suggesting that you remain true to that camp?
Yeah, it hasn't been discredited. What's happened is that what was thought, that the central banks creating large amounts of excess reserves by buying bonds would translate into large increases in money, and that's a precondition in the monetary scheme for more inflation, it didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen, we're still scratching our heads, but the reason it didn't happen is technical, very technical. For example, it has to do with raising capital ratios for banks, right? Banks need much more capital today to expand their balance sheets. As a result, and this is just in the last 3 or 4 years, as a result of the crisis, governments want banks to hold much more capital. Leverage ratios have been cut, and so that doesn't allow the banks to expand or to use their excess reserves and lend money as the textbooks would say they would. So this change is very, very dramatic. It's a very dramatic change, and as a result, we see money growing far more slowly than expected under conditions where regulators, bank regulators, and bank officials don't tinker with these capital rules. And this change is substantial, and I don't know how far it will go, but let's assume that it's gone pretty far, pretty close to the end. The process has gone pretty close to the end, so that now banks have the capital that they need. Chances are that going forward, they will be able to expand their balance sheets a little faster. Many of the smaller banks, regional banks, community banks, have had less pressure from regulators, capital pressures from regulators, so they can expand a little bit faster too. I don't think that I don't think that the main monetary tenet, which is money creates inflation, has been discredited. And I just simply believe that the mechanics of how money creation by a central bank transforms or gets translated into more money, that has been detoured at the moment by some technical considerations.
Okay, well, while we're on the subject, and I don't mean to make this call into something that becomes particularly academic, I think many people have been thinking about the effect of the Fed, not just on the play of individual assets, but on different strategies that they may be invested in. The Fed's zero interest rate policy, the quantitative easing coming from the ECB and from the BOJ has resulted in a couple of very obvious distortions. From a social point of view, they've created enormous inequalities in wealth. From an investment point of view, they dampened volatility to the detriment of a vast number of trading strategies. You're up 3% for the quarter and 15% for the year, but macro strategies have been challenged this year. Managed futures strategies, which are often grouped together with macro strategies, have really struggled in this environment of low volatility. What do you think is the future for the environment of volatility? I know this doesn't fall into your ambit as a specifically economic variable, but do you have a view of this? Do you have a view of what the kind of horizon will look like for skill-based managers like yourselves and futures traders and other macro managers?
If you have rising inflation, you will have rising volatility. And if you get rising inflation and it's unexpected rising inflation to the extent that it is going to be unexpected, I think you're going to have sharp increases in volatility.
You said earlier that you have a kind of intuition, a sense that inflation is perhaps pending, but you certainly don't seem to be talking about inflation as imminent. Like, can I press you a little bit on that and ask you to clarify?
Yeah, when I say imminent, I don't see. Let's say this: that I don't see the CPI numbers showing rapid inflation or inflation exceeding, let's say, 2.5% for maybe at least six months, especially given that commodity prices remain weak. But if you look at core prices, they already are, in Canada, for example, core prices are rising at about 2.5% per annum. In the U.S. at about 1.7 or 1.8. So they're beginning to approach the 2% mark, and it probably will exceed that. I don't have a feel for the timing, but I do think that probably we will see inflation to begin to accelerate before the end of next year.
Okay, let's turn to the portfolio. If we were to look at the portfolio last year of the global macro fund I'm speaking of, and I would ask you what did you have, I think your answer would be the same. You were long home builders. I think you were long airlines a year ago. You were still short emerging markets, India in particular, and also Brazil. And you were bearish on oil. So the language used to describe the portfolio was the same, but the portfolio is not at all the same. It's really radically different in the sense of its leverage and its concentration, its focus. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between now and last year? And, of course, the reason we want to talk about last year and earlier was that last year with the same portfolio, the returns were not just negative, but they were really dramatically negative and scary for many of us.
That's a good question. There are actually many differences, or not many, but very substantial differences between the earlier portfolio, the portfolio of 2, 3, and 4 years ago, and the portfolio of today in the way we operate. Let me give you two or three of them, which I think are very important. The earlier portfolios were very comfortable in that we, as long as we felt that we are able to balance or hedge risks, we didn't mind expanding that position and expanding leverage. And so we try to be careful about finding hedges and balances to every position that we had, and thought that at the very end we did not have a lot of net exposure. So what was targeted in the earlier period was a net balance or a net leverage. That was the target.
Similar to your equity hedge strategy, where you had no net exposure, is that
right? We thought we had little, and that allowed us to expand the portfolio and say, look, I mean, we like to do this, so well, let's find a way to balance that and see whether we can still make money on that difference. And so we went out and very comfortably put on many positions, always in the belief that our net was not very much exposed. We don't do that today anymore. Our experience has taught us that whether we use statistics or whether we use concepts, these balances or these hedges were illusory. They were not real. There were moments of time, there were weeks and months of time, extremely frustrating periods in which the hedges actually worked the reverse. You know, things that were
Texas hedges. Texas hedges.
Yes, and so we slowly. I mean, I must say, much too slowly, but came to realize that strategy won't work. That won't work anymore. And that what we needed to do was actually target gross leverage. And that is, I don't care whether I'm short stocks and long. Long bonds or something, and therefore I would think that maybe there is some kind of a hedge there. No, each one of those positions to us was an enemy in a way, a risk enemy in a way, and so we had to begin targeting growth leverage. So that's a huge difference in the approach. So that's number one, instead, and I can discuss that further, but. Directional moves, if they were anticipated, and
Al, if I can interrupt you for just a sec, well, we're on the theme of leverage. Have you placed a cap on leverage?
I'll come to that in a minute.
Okay.
And directional moves, if we anticipated and felt strongly about it, were handled as a separate trade. So it wasn't as if we were looking necessarily to hedge. A directional bet was a directional bet, just like it would be buying airlines was a directional bet. With market anticipation of where the market was going was also a directional bet, and so we played that separately. In addition to that, what we did is we placed a cap on the growth leverage, and we said, you know what, growth leverage is dangerous. I don't care whether we can make a case statistically or conceptually that we're hedged. Growth leverage is dangerous, and therefore we should have a cap. And so over time and over months, we tinkered a little bit with levels of leverage that felt right, and came to realize that probably we should be somewhere between 2.5 and 3 times leverage, growth leverage, and that's where we are, between 2.5 and 3. We navigate between 2.5 and 3. Okay. So second very important difference. Because of larger, more diversified portfolios, we had less of an emphasis on timing, and that's very important. We did not have to worry so much about timing because we had so many different positions and so many different plays that you know, some of them will happen, and so we didn't care about timing, right?
Right.
And that gave you a certain, it lulled you into some complacency.
Lost your twitchiness.
Exactly. And so, and we don't do that today anymore. Today, timing is extremely important. Whereas, let's say in the past, we would look at a timing could be somewhere between 6 months and 12 months. If it happens, it's good. Today, we want to know that position will start actually accruing to our benefit immediately, almost immediately. And so we are demanding of our positions, right? And we are on our toes. We don't allow that timing issue to lull us into complacency. We want to have immediate results. And so the emphasis on timing is very different. And the fact that we have lower leverage doesn't allow us now to play everything on the board, everything that we like on the board. We have temptations, but we have to restrain our temptations, right? And so now we have to say, well, you know, we have to choose. We have to choose. What do we choose? Let's see, one more thing I mean, it's very profound, the difference. It's nuanced, but very profound, these differences.
Well, it puts the pressure on accuracy, and it forces everyone on the team to a higher level of perception.
That's right. Now, for instance, in the past, volatility we thought was controlled by diversification. Well, the more diversified, the more pieces you have on the board, the less volatility you will have, especially if you net down to zero, near zero. it wasn't true. It just wasn't true. And so we had to learn from experience. And now volatility is controlled by a cap on leverage. And we say, you know what, if we are 2.5 to 1 or maybe up to 3 to 1, chances are, and I can't be sure, but chances are that we probably won't be much more volatile than, let's say, the S&P 500. So these are changes. These are big changes for us. And they are, so you're right. I think you started with a question. We have similar positions as we had, very similar positions that we had in the past. Yes, but we play them differently. And because we play them differently, they will produce, obviously, different results.
Okay, good. So we try to keep the call down to 45 minutes. We're, by my watch, 4 minutes short of that, but we've gone through all the questions. Is there anything that you want to add, Al, before we close it up?
No. I want to say that, you know, we did have a, I think I want to add this, and I'm not sure, this is maybe also a little bit of a change, but I want to add that we used to have a strategy that we used for many years, and it was very profitable for many years. It was called a market neutral strategy for
equity hedge. Hedge.
And it was a part of the global macro. It was maybe it would take up between 20% and 30% of the equity of the global macro. Today, funny enough, today we have a similar strategy for the fund as a whole. And the question is, what is the difference? And there is a significant difference. The market neutral fund at the time, the equity hedge, we called it the equity hedge, was designed to be always market neutral. And because it was designed to be market neutral, we always tried to make sure that we were neutral. I mean, neutral in the sense that you can be as neutral as you can. But we were hedging with indices. We were hedging with stocks that we felt, for example, we needed to be more. We needed to add to our short position. We would add to shorts that we thought would do worse than the market on the upside. Not shorts necessarily that would go down, but shorts that would do worse than the market on the upside.
Right.
It was a desire to hedge. And so market neutral was the market neutrality was accomplished by doing what we saw over time as a secondary type of a trade. It was a secondary trade. It was not a desired optimal trade. It was a non-optimal way of doing it. It produced very good results for many years. And up until 2 or 3 years ago, it was actually good and positive, maybe 3 years ago. So, but as the markets became more efficient, it became more difficult, and then we realized that that wasn't working anymore. What we do today, even though it looks similar, and we are still long short, you call it, that's the difference between market neutral and long short. We are long short today. We were long short then, but then it was market neutral. Today it's not market neutral. Today we move from the bottom up, and we identify interesting opportunities, and we go with them. And whatever that leads us to, it may lead us to a net long, as it does today, or it may lead us to a net short position, as it may do in the future. But it's not important. We don't care about the neutrality of it. If we felt the market is going to go down, as we felt, for instance, September, we felt the market was going to go down, then we took some action and we bought, not for hedging purposes, but as a trade, we bought puts. And that was a trade. That wasn't a hedge. And I think that's a very important, also subtle difference between the way we operate in the past and today. Just wanted to add that. I thought that makes it a more complete picture.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that. Thank you very much for a quarter of good results and speaking on behalf of all the investors. Thank you very much for a good start to the final quarter of 2015. And on behalf of everyone, best wishes for continued success. Thanks for the time.
Okay. Thank you, David. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Albert. That can-